President Trump fires FBI Director James Comey, and questions abound this morning. Republican Senator John McCain from Arizona asks on CNN, why now?
When you fire probably, arguably, the most respected person in America, you better have a very good explanation. And so far, I haven't seen that.
We're going to be looking into the Comey firing. A constitutional expert is in studio to help us better understand what's happened. And we're taking your questions. Call us now at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455, or connect with us on Twitter. Our handle is at 21st Show. We're also going to be looking at gun violence through a mental health lens.
Almost universally, the people who have become involved in committing acts of violence have been exposed to trauma themselves.
Examining how trauma affects violence. I'm Nova Safo. That's all coming up on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo, in for Nyla Boodoo. We're all trying to make sense today of President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey. To say the firing is a bombshell would be an understatement. To call it unusual would be accurate. An FBI director has only been fired once before. The White House says it's had problems with Comey for weeks and that he should not have spoken out publicly last year about the Clinton email investigation. Congressional Democrats and some Republicans are questioning the timing as the FBI continues investigating Russian attempts to interfere with the presidential election and any possible ties to the Trump campaign. Vice President Mike Pence tried to put some of these questions to rest this morning, insisting President Trump is not under investigation and that the Comey firing was not connected to the Russian probe. Here's what he had to say.
He's not under investigation. And as former Director Clapper of the Department of the Director of National Intelligence said, there is no evidence of collusion between our campaign and any Russian officials. That's
but
not what. But let me be clear with you. That was not what this is about.
Between campaign officials and Russian
Look,
officials.
That's not what this was about. The president took strong and decisive leadership here to put the safety and security of the American people first by accepting the recommendation of the Deputy Attorney General to remove Director Comey as the head of the FBI. The American people have to have confidence in the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
All right. We want to give you an opportunity to ask questions about Comey's firing, especially as it relates to presidential powers and the Constitution. We've already gotten some really good questions on social media this morning, and you can join in by calling us at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also send in questions on our Facebook page. Look for The 21st, and we're on Twitter. The handle is at 21st Show. Just before we went to air this morning, we spoke with Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois for her reaction. Here's what she had to say. Senator Duckworth, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
It's my pleasure to be on. Thank you.
You said in a statement that you have significant concerns over Comey's firing. What are those concerns?
Well, the concern is that the man just testified that he was conducting an independent investigation into the ties of the Russian government to Trump campaign associates, and now he's been fired. And Jeff Sessions, who said he would recluse himself from all Russian investigations, was the one who recommended his firing. That's pretty suspicious.
The White House, of course, is saying this has to do with how Comey handled the Clinton email investigation last year. Do you believe their assertion?
Well, listen, I don't think the average person believes that the White House fired Comey because they, were defending Hillary. I think the more likely, thing that people will believe is that he's been conducting this Russia investigation. Look, either way, the White House can certainly put my mind at rest if they would come out and say that all ongoing investigations into ties the Russian government to the Trump campaign, as well as to their efforts to disrupt elections could continue, and it would continue in an independent way. And I think that if the White House would come out and support a special prosecutor to conduct an independent, nonpartisan investigation, we would all feel better.
Now, of course, there's been a lot of talk since Comey's firing that the FBI's investigation is being handled by career investigators, not political operatives. Isn't that true? Why should we be worried about how the investigation might progress without Comey?
Well, here's the problem. In the firing letters, both from Jeff Sessions and Rosenstein and the White House statement, nowhere in there have they actually reaffirmed that any and all FBI investigations are continuing and are being handled by career FBI professionals. They've not said that. And I think that that is a glaring omission. If they were ongoing, if they were not trying to disrupt them, then they would actually be able to say that. And you know, as I said, the White House could put a lot of minds to rest if they would do that. And better yet, just support a special counsel that would conduct an independent investigation headed by a career professional, not somebody who's politically appointed. You know, when I travel across Illinois and I talk to constituents, time and again, people say there should be an independent investigation into Russia's involvement.
And what's the Senate's role here? Can the Senate expand its investigation to the Russian probe?
You know, I don't see any reason why that can't continue, but I think that the American people would be better served if there were a special prosecutor headed by a nonpartisan, non-political appointee leading an independent investigation. Then there'd be no question of partisanship.
Senator Duckworth, you'll also be voting to confirm the next FBI director, whoever the president nominates. What kind of nominee are you looking for?
Well, you know, I think that we're going to have to talk about that because I don't know that we can move forward without some sort of assurances from the White House that they're going to nominate someone who is bipartisan. I also think that we need to deal with this issue right now of a special prosecutor.
All right. And there's been some conjecture that Comey could still participate in investigating, at least from the Senate. There's been some speculation online, at least. Is that at all a possibility?
I'm not sure. I do know that the Senate Intelligence Committee just issued a joint letter signed by both the Republican chairman and the Democratic ranking member. Asking Comey to testify. So I would have to believe that that means that the Senate investigation is ongoing and that they will at the very least be calling Comey to be a witness.
And were you disappointed in the way Comey handled the Clinton email investigation last year? Did you have concerns over how he did his job?
Well, I certainly did. And I actually have more concern now after the hearings that happened just earlier this week that showed that he also had information on the Trump campaign and on Michael Flynn, General Flynn in particular, but chose not to release that information. Everything in how Mr. Comey conducted himself was very unusual and not the normal procedure that the FBI would handle these investigations, especially of someone who had not been charged. But then to have equivalent information that would have hurt the Trump campaign and have withheld that, we're just finding that out now, is something that is deeply troubling.
So are you then concerned more that Comey was fired or that he was fired now?
I'm concerned that he was fired now. Why wasn't he fired previously? And if he was fired now, you know, I would like to know what is going to happen with the ongoing investigations. I think that the way we put that to rest is for the White House and for Mr. Sessions to come out and say, look, all investigations will keep on going. They will go on without a political appointee being involved, and that they can even better yet come out and say that they support a special counsel headed by a career FBI official, you know, career Justice Department official. That's how we put this to rest. And I think that's where my constituents would feel better, knowing that it was not a partisan effort.
All right, Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois, thanks so much for joining us. Joining us now to make sense of this story is Vikram Amar. He's the dean of the University of Illinois College of Law and one of the country's foremost constitutional law experts. Dean Amar, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So did the president, I'm going to start with a very kind of basic question here. Did the president act within his legal powers?
Yes. I think there's really no question that a president has the statutory and constitutional authority to remove FBI directors for any reason at all. You know, there's a lot of confusion, I think, about where the FBI is located in government. You know, you'll see headlines that say FBI clashes with DOJ.
Well,
Department of Justice. FBI is part of the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice is under the head of the Attorney General, who is a presidential appointee and a cabinet member. And ultimately, the president under the Constitution is the investigator and prosecutor in chief. So the president has the legal authority to do these things. Now, over time, there has developed, perhaps quite wisely, a tradition of a hands-off approach with regard to certain investigations, especially investigations of people who are connected to the high levels of the executive branch, whereby the FBI and other members of DOJ are given some independent running room. So this whole episode is really about the political motivations and the political optics and the timing of the termination. If President Trump had fired Comey upon taking office in January because of Comey's very questionable execution of duties over the past year, and everyone agrees, I think most people agree, I should say, that Comey didn't do a very good job in very various ways, I think we would not have this controversy. As Senator Duckworth put her finger on it, the question is why now and what does it have to do with the FBI's ongoing investigation into ties between Russia and people associated with the Trump campaign? That's what makes it look bad, and that's what makes this a really important moment.
One of the terms that's bandied about a lot around this story is historic. Mm-hmm. FBI directors don't really get fired very often. It's happened once before during the Clinton administration. Why don't they usually get fired? And what in the world happened this time?
Well, one of the reasons they don't get fired is because we haven't had that many of them since J. Edgar Hoover was there for many decades. So in 1976, after Hoover—
We've had some like 16 or 18 FBI directors.
That's right. And most of them end up coming and going on their own. Mm-hmm. They don't serve a full 10 years. After Hoover, Congress passed a statute in 1976 that limited FBI directors to one 10-year term, absent exceptional circumstances. And there's only been one FBI director, Bob Mueller, who served more than 10 years. So most of them serve less than 10 years. You're right that one of them was fired. Bill Clinton fired Bill Sessions, and this is the second time it's happened. But we don't really have decades and decades and centuries of history to draw upon. So I think the problem with Trump's firing of Comey is not that it's historically unprecedented. Mm-hmm. It's that it takes place at a moment when everyone knows the FBI is doing an investigation into the Russian interference and possible connections with Trump campaign associates.
Now, Attorney General Sessions is, of course, was Comey's direct boss. And we've had some really good questions online about this story. And one of them was about Sessions. It came from a Reddit user, and it was whether Sessions' letter to recommend firing Comey ran afoul of his promise, Sessions' promise, to recuse himself from the Russia investigation altogether. Does that run afoul of that?
I don't think so, because that letter, like Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein's report,
who only came on like a few weeks ago,
right? And he did an analysis of whether Comey should stay shortly after taking his role. Neither of those documents mentions Russia as a reason for getting rid of Director Comey. So to say that Attorney General Sessions could not weigh in on whether to get rid of the FBI director because there is this Russian probe going on is basically to say the attorney general can have nothing to do with the FBI, and that would cut too broadly.
Another great question for one of our listeners coming from online. It's from Elizabeth, who asks, who actually has authority to appoint an independent investigator regarding possible illegal interactions with a foreign government? And do citizens have any protection to ensure that an independent investigation actually takes place?
So it depends on what we mean by the term independence. Hmm. after Watergate, and there's been a lot of parallels drawn to the so-called Saturday Night Massacre and Watergate, but after Richard Nixon's transgressions were uncovered and he was forced out of office, Congress passed a law that provided for the appointment of a counsel or a prosecutor who had legal independence, meaning once he was appointed or she was appointed by a panel of judges, she or he could not be removed except for good cause. They couldn't be removed just because the president or the attorney general doesn't like what they're doing. That is the statute that brought us the famous independent prosecutors concerning Iran-Contra in the 1980s and concerning Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky in the 1990s. That's what brought us Ken Starr and the impeachment of Bill Clinton. The experience with the Independent Counsel Act led everyone to believe that there's only one thing worse than having prosecutors who can be removed by the very people they're investigating, and that is having a prosecutor who's accountable to no one, who has a $50 million budget running around doing whatever he wants. So in 1999, that statute was not renewed. Both Democrats and Republicans in Congress didn't like it. So there's no provision in law today to appoint a prosecutor who has formal legal independence. What could happen, and this is what Senator Duckworth was referring to, is within the DOJ structure, within the Department of Justice, you could appoint a special counsel to do an investigation, and you could very publicly promise that person that he or she would have independence. And sometimes political promises are more important than legal protections, because if you violate that promise and then try to remove that person, then the public is going to be very upset, the same way they were upset when Nixon fired the first special counsel, Archibald Cox, and it was that public pressure that forced Richard Nixon to appoint a second person, Leon Jaworski, who then helped bring Nixon down.
All right. We have a lot more to talk about. We're going to take a quick break and come back with Professor Vikram Amar of the Illinois College of Law, one of our country's top experts in constitutional law. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing students and scholars for their fields by offering access to today's cutting-edge equipment and technology within advanced library environments and facilities. The University Library at Illinois.
Back to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo sitting in for Nyla Boodoo, and we're speaking about the firing of FBI Director James Comey by President Trump. And we're joined by Dean of the University of Illinois College of Law, Vikram Amar. Again, Mr. Amar, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
We were just before the break, we were speaking about comparisons to Nixon and Watergate. There have been inevitable comparisons, numerous comparisons. How is this similar to Watergate and how is it different?
Sure. So in 1973, President Nixon fired Archibald Cox, who was a special prosecutor who was investigating the Watergate break-in. And the reason that people are drawing comparisons is because as then, yesterday, the president fired somebody who was publicly known to be doing an investigation that might have implicated the president. Now, the president has said that he is not under investigation. You heard that from Vice President Pence, that the president is not under investigation. I don't know how we know who and who isn't under investigation. The whole point of an investigation is it takes different directions. Mm-hmm. The reality is certainly the FBI has been looking into Russian interference and connections to Trump associates. Whether they could ever lead to Trump is an open question. So there's at least the possibility that this is an investigation into the president, and that's why it seems similar. You're trying to get rid of the guy who might be having the dirt on you. Now, there are important differences. One is Archibald Cox was investigating only Watergate. So firing him necessarily involved an inference that you didn't like what he was doing with respect to Watergate. As we've already heard, Comey has done a lot of things that a lot of people think are problematic. And so we're not exactly sure why President Trump fired him at this time. Even Senator Duckworth, who, like me, has some doubts about the explanation, pointed out that there are some recent events, including Comey's recent testimony about what happened over the summer and the fall, that could shed new light on how Comey didn't do a good job and has lost the confidence of the American public. There are other differences as well. The FBI director is going to have to be replaced. And so we'll get more information about President Trump when he picks the person who has to then be confirmed by the Senate. If he picks somebody who has bipartisan credibility and who seems as if she or he is going to pursue the investigations zealously, that'll send a different message than if he picks somebody who has close ties to him personally and who seems loyal to him personally. There was a lot of political pressure at the time to in 73 to replace Archibald Cox, and so President Nixon did. I think there'll be similar pressure here to on the president to pick someone for the FBI director who has credibility and maybe also pick another special counsel. But this leads to the biggest difference between 73 and today, and this is something we really got to keep our eyes on. In 73, you had a lot of Republicans who wanted to make sure that Watergate got a fair investigation. It's not entirely clear that the Republican mainstream today on Capitol Hill has a lot of passion for this particular investigation. True, you have Lindsey Graham and John McCain and others, but until and unless the Republican leadership joins with the Democrats to insist that President Trump give this Russia inquiry a fair course, then we're not in the same place we were in 73. And that's the big question to keep our eyes on. I personally think if Russia interfered with our democracy and if either campaign had anything to do with it, that's a huge deal. But the American public has to be the one to weigh in on that and put pressure on Republicans to join Democrats in that regard.
And you think there should be a special prosecutor completely independent from the chain of command answering to the president?
I think some depends on who replaces Comey as FBI director. But since the attorney general is already recused from any investigation and there's already now this cloud surrounding the FBI director and who replaces Comey, I think it wouldn't be a bad idea to have a prosecutor or an investigator, I should say, with broad bipartisan credibility and promises of political independence. I think that wouldn't be a bad idea at all. Vice President Pence said that the American people have to have confidence in the FBI director. That's why James Comey was let go. Well, even more important than confidence in the FBI director, the American people have to have confidence in the president. And I think the only way to really get that is to have an investigation whose outcome will be accepted as legitimate by the American people on both sides of the aisle.
And is this simply a matter of perception and politics, or is something greater at stake?
Now, I do think something greater is at stake. I don't think that, as I said at the outset, I don't think President Trump is violating any laws in having fired Comey. But if Russia interfered with our election and if people associated with either campaign had anything to do with that, that is a huge problem for American democracy. And I just hope the American people recognize it for the big problem that it is.
All right. Vikram Amar, Dean of Illinois College of Law, University of Illinois College of Law, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. There are unfortunately many communities in Illinois struggling with gun violence and many police officers in the state who face the tough task of trying to address it. They're getting some help in the form of better understanding of trauma and how it can both be born out of violence and cause violence. We're going to take a few minutes now to better understand this as well. Karen Sims joins me in the studio. She's a licensed therapist who helps communities facing trauma. Hi, Karen. And also joining us, Sean Johnson. He's a police officer with the University of Illinois Police Department. Welcome, Sean.
Hello.
On the line, on the phone, is from Chicago, is Rebecca Levin, Director of Strengthening Chicago's Youth at Lurie Children's Hospital. Rebecca, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Karen, let me start with you. What are some common misconceptions about what trauma really means?
So probably most people think about trauma as sort of being those discrete incidents, so things that happen to people. So people think about the big three, right? Sexual assault, domestic violence, those kinds of things. And so they don't real and people believe that it's only the things that you experience that really impact you. And so we've come to understand that trauma is much bigger and broader than that. We know that exposures to things like being in an environment that is violent, where there's a lot of adversity, can be traumatizing for some folks. We even know that things like structural violence, like an institutional violence, or things like racism can be experienced as trauma. They create a stress response. And so we're now rethinking trauma to be something bigger than just something that happened to you.
Sounds like you're really broadening the definition.
Yeah. And in part because we've got some biology. We're talking neurobiological. So we're talking about, we know things that stress you. So trauma are things that stress you in a way that's significant and impactful and sustainable. And so that's what helps us broaden the definition.
And how much of this that we're talking about is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder?
Great. And so if you think about PTSD being on the continuum, so there is the chronic stress that happens. So imagine if you, for those who remember being in school, it's finals week. And imagine finals week that doesn't end. So that's 30 days of finals, right? So that's just chronic stress where it does not let up. And then we can go from 30 days of finals to 30 days of finals, you having a bad experience with a roommate, having lots of problems that happen, having maybe your parent go through divorce, right? That's complicated, right, trauma. And then imagine, so you go through all of that, you take that stress, it doesn't let up, you add to it, and then imagine that you start to you've gone under so much stress, you can't sleep, you can't eat, you can't function, and you're having some nightmares about those 30 days of finals that don't let up. That's PTSD. So it's on the continuum from, chronic stress to extreme adversity, and the extreme adversity has a biological impact. We know PTSD is a significant change in the brain and the biology that comes. It's a normal response to really complex chronic stress.
Like you're trauma. Talking about rewiring of the
it's
brain?
It's a rewiring. So it fires. So what happens is you feel like you're always under threat. And so when you feel like you're always under threat, your body does some things to cope with that feeling under threat, which is why I think this whole concept of thinking about the need for law enforcement to understand trauma is so important and so vital, because it helps them understand and appreciate some of the realities of folks that they are serving and protecting.
Officer Johnson, she said law enforcement, that's our cue. How have you been evolving your understanding of trauma, and how has that been informing the work you do every day?
Well, taking the trauma-informed class and buying into what's been taught and having understanding from A to Z. And there are some other states, to Colorado, that are doing some good things, testing and assessing before from Head Start to kindergarten. And we are definitely seeing an uptick in violence, not just in Champaign and Springfield and Chicago and other cities throughout the United States. So the training is valuable and very informative.
I'm curious how, looking back, can you point to an experience you had that may have been puzzling to you in the past, and now you look back and think, that was a case of someone who was experiencing trauma, and now I would react to it differently?
Well, as an officer, when you're at a hot call, you may not consciously be thinking about that at that time because you're in the moment. And if those variables are in play, that's kind of difficult to consciously think about that at the time when you're at a call for service. Sure, has that happened? Yes. But at the time, we're dealing with the facts at hand, dealing with the call. So it's probably not going to come to play at that moment.
Yeah. And so how have the training you've been through and your broadened understanding of trauma changed your day-to-day work and interactions?
Maybe understand that maybe some people are in the process of getting some treatment and trying to deal with it, and maybe be patient and maybe share information with other people that can help the police, social service agencies, schools, other stakeholders that can maybe wrap around and maybe support the individual.
Karen, the officer Johnson mentioned training.
Yes.
Can you talk about what this training is that he was talking about? I think he gave away our lead here.
Champaign County is really unique. This area is unique because there are only a few places in the nation that are offering trauma-informed training to law enforcement. So we piloted a training through the Illinois Police Training Institute and really had a chance to talk to law enforcement about sort of the biology of trauma, what happens with the people that they serve, what they can do for themselves, so how trauma impacts them and their response. We spent a lot of time talking about just the whole brain piece. And then we talked about, so we actually did two parts of training. So the first part was sort of an introduction to the ideas, talked about best practices to address urban violence, which included having people have a relationship. So we talked a lot about how community policing actually helps in real practical ways in terms of building relationships, helps people with regulation, because if I know you, then I'm less likely to feel threatened by you. So how do you build those relationships so that you aren't always responding to a crisis? We talked about how to de-escalate, and that's a practice skill. And so we only had one. We talked about it, didn't have a chance to do a lot of activities around it. So how do you pay attention when someone is having a trauma response where you don't escalate the problem and cause more harm? And create somebody responding out of that. And then the second day of the training, we talked about best practices, so what other communities were doing. Really important to introduce, we talked about domestic violence, how to improve domestic violence response, how to improve forensic interviewing in a way that's trauma-informed, and also how to respond to households where they're children in a way that's much more trauma-informed. So sort of introducing, again, all of the best practices, and it's a 2.5-day training. So with every training, I always tell people training is only as good as the reinforcement. And so the idea is to come back and revisit those conversations, because if you've ever gone to a great workshop, then you're like, this is the best thing ever. We always call it bobblehead training,
right?
You're nodding and you grab that folder, you put it on the shelf. And if you don't get a chance to practice it, the folder sits on the shelf. And so we're working to think about what those next steps are to support implementation, because that's how we learn.
Yeah.
We learn through practicing reinforcement.
And how many officers have roughly about gone through this course already?
So right now we started with leadership. So primarily police chiefs, captains, people sort of who were decision makers for the 7-county mobile. So it's the mobile unit. So there are all the law enforcement in this area. So the counties, countywide, sort of come together to sort of be like a cadre. And so we had Parkland and U of I and Homer and Urbana, Champaign. Like, it was a broad group of folks who came, but all of the leadership. So that's what we had at first.
And just quickly, in a few seconds, have you started to get some feedback on how officers are changing their day-to-day work, or how the training is starting to affect them?
So again, we had the training. The last day was in March 7th. People are trying to think about how to put it in practice, how to mobilize it, also how to bring it downstream, right? Like, how to take what the police chiefs who are in, how to think about what policies look like. So that's where we started. And so we want to get it downstream into, like, people who are doing day-to-day work in the field. there's been some changes administratively with the Illinois Police Training Institute that sort of made that complicated. But we're working on that, and we've got lots of ideas about that. So and lots of commitments locally.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and come back to talk a lot more about trauma, policing, and violence. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nev Wasafo in for Nyla Boodoo. We're speaking about trauma, its effects on violence, how it is affected by violence, and policing, and how we can inform better policing going forward. We're joined by Karen Sims, a licensed therapist who specializes in helping communities facing trauma, Sean Johnson of the University of Illinois Police Department. They're here in studio with me. And we're joined by the phone by Rebecca Levin, the director of Strengthening Chicago's Youth Program at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Rebecca Levin, thank you as well for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ms. Levin, how does understanding trauma help violence, help stop violence?
I think there's a real misperception about violence, that violence is committed by bad people who live in bad communities. And Karen did a great job of describing how trauma and adversity can rewire the brain. And that rewiring really leaves people vulnerable to violence, and both to it increases their likelihood of committing acts of violence. It also increases their likelihood of being further victimized. A lot of people who work in the trauma field like to say, hurt people, hurt people. We also know that communities are traumatized. So entire communities that are experiencing high levels of violence, high poverty, jobs are leaving, residents are moving away, that community really has had its exposure to trauma and had the community fabric rewired, you could say. So if you understand what's happened to these individuals and these communities, then you can focus on understanding, like Officer Johnson said, really having more patience, and you can look at prevention, how to build resilience in those individuals and those communities and help them develop coping skills.
Ms. Levin, how does children's exposure to trauma affect how they react to just everyday daily situations?
Sure. So Karen talked a little bit about how people who are exposed to trauma and have had their brains rewired in this way really feel like they're always under threat. So you could have an incident, say a young person who experiences, he's exposed to a lot of violence in the home, and he's just always kind of operating on level 11 on a scale of 1 to 10. He's just always hyper alert, hyper aroused. Well, if another kid bumps into him in the hall at school, something that is just a completely accidental, non-threatening sort of thing, that young person who's always hyper alert, hyper aroused, may view that as a threat and may instinctively lash out and say, punch that other young person. So you can see how violence can pretty quickly escalate because people's brains have been rewired by the trauma that they're exposed to.
And is this fueling the gun violence in Chicago, this kind of hyper-threatened response to things that maybe folks who haven't faced trauma might respond to in a more or less aggressive way?
Absolutely. So a lot of what we see in the violence in Chicago is absolutely people acting out from these sorts of interpersonal slights. Someone flirts with someone's girlfriend, someone insults someone, but that it quickly escalates into very serious and lethal acts of violence, in part made all the more lethal because of the easy access to firearms.
Karen Sims, I can see you here in the studio wanting to jump in. Yeah.
So I just wanted to say, so absolutely, everything that was said, and it's complex, right? So it is the rewiring of biological responses. So, and that could be not necessarily having the same ability to see things, to sort of one of the responses to trauma is to sort of feel numb. And so, because that's a protective factor where you sort of don't feel impacted by stress all the time, you sort of numb yourself out. So that's an issue. In Chicago and in Champaign, it is the things that feed chronic stress. So real and perceived racism, institutional issues, housing, anything that keeps me. So there are the real threats that happen on an individual level. And then there's the not having a safe place to live or not feeling like my neighborhood is secure and that I have to protect it. When you feel like your basic needs can't be met, right, that increases your level of fright, flight, freeze response. And a lot of what you see in places where people are responding with high levels of community violence, there's a correlation between adverse community experiences and adverse and responding in a way that looks like a trauma response. So it looks like violence because one of my favorite stories is if you think about Walter Mosley talked about being an African-American man and how many times he experiences real and perceived threats of racism. So people walking across the street, people perceiving him as threatening, people perceiving like Walter Mosley, writer, always living with a higher level of stress. So imagine if I don't have the sort of resources and protective factors and I'm living in a world where I feel like my life doesn't value or that people don't value me. And I have access to guns and weapons. And so when I feel like my life, my block, my neighborhood is at risk, I always say we grew up in a Western culture. I do what people did in Western society. I protect me and mine. And I have a rewiring of the brain that makes it easier for me to act on that and to not stop and necessarily think it through. It's not intentional. Like, I'm not necessarily always trying to kill somebody. I'm really just trying to protect mine. It's a fight response when I feel threatened that happens sort of automatic.
You know, it's interesting what you're saying because I've covered Chicago violence a great deal. And I can tell you from personal experience, when I cover these stories, when I write up these stories, certainly online, the comment section online of a story isn't necessarily indicative of what society as a whole thinks, but it is a glimpse. And the level of racism in the comment section of any story I do inevitably about Chicago violence is really quite extraordinary.
Absolutely.
And so my question to you, I think you're alluding to this a little bit. How does race play into this and the kind of underlying current of race relations play into this kind of cycle of trauma?
Lots of different ways. First of all, there is the whole concept of implicit bias. So there's no way that you exist in the world and society and don't perceive black men as being a threat, right? You just get bombarded. That's who gets showed. That's the image that gets seen over and over again. Not only are black men perceived as a threat, but also, you know, for lack of better, there's a perception that black men's lives don't matter as much, right? For a lot of different reasons, both internal and external to the community. And black men so internalize that narrative, right? And so so that's sort of abstractly. And then concretely, just think about, we were talking about this before we came into the studio. Lack of employment opportunities, lack of housing. We were talking about what would happen if you have an experience with law enforcement, you develop a felony, you want to get back in your home, and there are policies, there's structural violence that gives in your way of being reconnected with your children and your family because you can't live in housing, you can't have access to employment, then you start to feel boxed in and caged in. And what we know when people feel boxed and caged, you tend to be more easily set off, right? If I take away your resources over and over again and threaten you constantly, you're going to be more on edge. And when you talk to many, many young men of color, they feel, they internalize, they don't necessarily have the language to understand that it's racism, but they feel constantly under threat.
Officer Johnson, I'm seeing you nodding your head.
Yeah, and I think what we find is repeat offenders, and that's a big topic. And it's tough, and it's definitely a challenge, and no one's going to dispute that. So it's a matter of getting stakeholders together, and even the offenders themselves, they've got to be a part of that too. And it's tough. It's tough, and it's not easy.
Rebecca Levin in Chicago, when you see kind of this trauma with an undercurrent of race in it, are you seeing generations affected by this, where the parents are affected and the children are affected, and then the parents also are ill-equipped to help the children because they themselves are affected by the same ailment?
Absolutely. And when I think about the generational effects of trauma, I think about not only generations of families, but going back to your question a minute ago about racism, I think about generations of policies as well. And so the level of violence that we're experiencing on the south and west side of Chicago is the inevitable consequence of decades of policies that have continued to marginalize communities of color. So that's not an accidental thing. From redlining to the war on drugs and mass incarceration of people of color, these communities have been continually marginalized. There's been disinvestment in these communities and the conditions for violence have created. So then you have families that have grown up generation after generation in communities experiencing concentrated disadvantage and high levels of adversity and trauma. And those parents and grandparents are ill-equipped then to be able to help their children cope with the trauma that they're experiencing on a day-to-day basis. We learn how to parent from our own parents. And so if generation after generation, families are experiencing this adversity, they don't get a chance to pass on the resilience generation to generation.
Karen Sims, are you finding that there are grandparents and parents who, do they even know that they're traumatized?
That is the basic question, you know, because, you know, again, they've done experiments. When you're under chronic stress, sometimes you don't even feel it, right? Like if there's the whole concept of a foot on your back, you don't necessarily, if I do elephant training and if I keep you oppressed long enough, you just learn to stay in your place. You don't even know it. And so part of what we do in the community through the Champaign County Coalition is work to educate the community about some of these issues so that people in the community understand that this is not an okay response, that things can be better, that some of the stresses, and also talk about coping strategies and this whole concept of protecting factors. There are things that we can do, not necessarily, there are things that we can do across the board. So on an individual household level to help people know, but also in terms of advocacy on an institutional level to help policymakers understand how those policies promote healing, but also get in the way of healing and create more structural problems. I will want to say this whole concept of intergenerational trauma, I think what Charlie Rose's brain series, he did one on childhood adversity, it's a go-to, right? So it's phenomenal because what we know about epigenetics, so that's how what gets passed on through genes, is it takes the things that I experience could be passed on to my children, particularly adverse things, for three generations. So, and then if I have a trigger, like lots of stress, the things that I pass on to my children will get manifested. So if I'm an anxious person and under a lot of stress, that impacts my pregnancy. It impacts how my children are impacted, and then it impacts sort of how they show up as children. So, when I do training, and I talked about this in the training, we're not talking about just addressing trauma. We're talking about healing communities, healing brains, and also doing social equalizing. Because if we don't really change how we treat each other and operate in a way that's more healing and loving, but also deal with some of these structural issues, we're creating gaps that sometimes we may not be able to correct. But we are at a prime time because we have knowledge now and skills and capacity to do things better. And I feel like we are, right, like we would be remiss not to do it if we really want to bring everybody up. Like if we want to make sure that everybody can be employed and everyone has an opportunity and everyone has access and everyone can learn, then we really have to take this whole trauma-informed communities work very seriously and work on addressing childhood adversity.
And Officer Johnson, what's next for your department in terms of helping to broaden this understanding of trauma and policing?
Well, we're going to work with the mobile training unit, work with our department leadership, work with the Champaign County Coalition, and continue to build on the 2.5-day training that was offered to us.
And Rebecca Levin, just in about 30 seconds, what kind of policy changes you want to see driven by this better understanding of trauma?
So I think if we understand that we aren't talking about bad people in bad communities, then we know we have to invest in equity. So we need to reverse that tide of disinvesting in communities to create concentrated disadvantage. The other thing I would say, if we want to stem the tide of the lethality of violence in Chicago, we need to address the guns. Mm-hmm. And so common sense gun violence prevention legislation is critical right now.
All right, Rebecca Levin of Lurie Children's Hospital, thank you for joining us. And
thank
Karen, as well as Karen
Sims.
Thank
you Sims, so much, Rebecca.
And Karen Sims and Sean Johnson, thank you for joining us as well. I appreciate
sure.
you taking your time. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. We're produced by Christine Herman and Alan Montesillo. Arbrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Nova Safo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.